I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Today is Jackie Robinson Day, and the city of Philadelphia is apologizing to Robinson for the abuse and mistreatment he received 69 years ago when he came to play against the Phillies. Robinson faced racial taunts on the field, especially by manager Ben Chapman, and he was denied a room by the Benjamin Franklin Hotel. Councilwoman Helen Gim authored the resolution that was passed unanimously by City Council that's being sent to Robinson's widow, Rachel Robinson. Our guest, Jonathan Eig, is the author of a book called Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season. And Jonathan Eig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Branch Rickey famously said to Jackie Robinson he wanted him to have the guts not to fight back. How much was that tested by the Phillies?
It was tested a great deal, and it was really the first test for Robinson in the major leagues once his career began. He was also tested in spring training the year before, a few weeks before. He was tested in the minor leagues. But the test on the big league level was the most important because everybody was watching, and there was still the sense that he might be forced out, that if he knuckled under, if he was broken, this grand experiment would end. So when the Phillies came to Brooklyn for that first time, they really rode him hard. They wanted to see what he was made of and see if he really would turn the other cheek.
And what did he say, or what did they say, and what was his response?
Well, the attacks in Brooklyn were pretty much racist, full of stereotypes. You know, go back to the cotton field, calling him words that we prefer not to use today, and basically saying that his teammates were going to become, you know, sick, infested with disease from just being around him. They were just taunting him in the crudest way they could think of, and these were, you know, a lot of Southern men. They knew a lot of very creative ways to express themselves when it came to race, and they let him have it with everything they could think of.
And what was the effect on Robinson himself?
Robinson said that there was a moment where he really thought about chucking it all, that he would just go over there and bash someone's teeth in and walk away and end this thing right here, because he was a very temperamental guy. He was not the kind of person who was inclined to turn the other cheek. Really, all his life, as a child, when people threw rocks at him and called him names, he picked up the rocks and threw them back. When he was harassed by white police officers growing up in Pasadena, he did not back down, which was, you know, a very dangerous thing to do for a black teenager in the 1940s and 30s. So he was he was court-martialed as well in the Army for refusing to go to the back of a bus. So this was not a guy who was inclined to turn the other cheek, and he really had to restrain himself.
You talk about his going to, or the Phillies, I should say, going to Brooklyn and what Jackie Robinson faced there. Not so long after that, he comes to Philadelphia. What happens in this city?
Well, you know, there was a huge uproar after the events in Brooklyn, and it was for a lot of white people, it was a wake-up call. You know, they, especially white people in Brooklyn who were, you know, used to living in a melting pot, they were shocked. They had never seen a black person attacked this way in public, and it actually generated a lot of sympathy for Robinson. So in some ways, it backfired on the Phillies. Instead of forcing Robinson out, it actually created more support for him, the commissioners of baseball actually demanded that the Phillies apologize back then in 1947, ordered Ben Chapman to keep his mouth shut and to make a gesture of support for Robinson. So by the time the Dodgers traveled to Philadelphia, it was not exactly a loving reception. In fact, the general manager of the Phillies still said he was thinking about having his team refuse to take the field. And Branch Rickey said, go ahead, you know, you don't want to take the field, fine, we'll accept the forfeit, and we'll put the W in our, you know, in our column, and we'll go home, but you got to forfeit the game. So the Phillies set up they would play, and in fact, Ben Chapman agreed to pose for a picture before the game with Robinson, sort of a peacemaking gesture, although Robinson declined to shake hands with him. So the response in Philadelphia was not nearly as rough as it had been in Brooklyn the week before.
I've looked at that photo. Robinson has a broad smile on his face. You know, obviously a very public expression of, I'm not sure what, some kind of truce with him and Ben Chapman. But inside, what was he thinking? What was he feeling?
My hunch is, and we can only guess what Robinson was thinking, my hunch, he was a very competitive man, my hunch is he felt like he'd won this battle, right? If Chapman had been forced by the commissioners of baseball to pose for a publicity shot, basically to eat crow, then Robinson had won that round. And he was still in the lineup, he was still playing, he was going to get out there on the field and do his best to defeat the Phillies. My guess is that Robinson was feeling a little bit better about himself that day.
And why was Ben Chapman so aggressive against Jackie Robinson? I mean, the things he said, as you said, these are things we could say them on the radio. I mean, they're just unbelievably racist and offensive.
Yeah, I think that's
what does
reasons.
That tell us about Ben Chapman?
I think there's two things that tell us about Chapman. One is that he believed that bench jockeying was an effective tool to get in players' heads, and that he did the same thing against DiMaggio with Italian slurs. He did the same thing against Hank Greenberg with Jewish slurs. He did the same thing about Southern ball players with questioning their intelligence. He just thought that if he could get under a player's skin, it gave him a competitive advantage. I think the other thing it tells us is that he was a racist. But, you know, a lot of ball players were. Most ball players were. And you know, baseball was a Southern game. You know, more than a third of the players in Major League Baseball came from the South back then. You know, Phil Rizzuto told me that he was intimidated going into the Yankee clubhouse because there were so many Southerners talking about hunting and fishing and, you know, speaking with these funny accents that he didn't understand because he grew up in New York. Even for a New Yorker, that Southern culture could be intimidating. So there's a real sense among these ball players that they don't know how to handle being around a black person, and it scares them, and they're worried that they're going to go home and be called, soft, that they accepted a black player, that they're going to be criticized for that. They may be ridiculed for that. So there was a lot of apprehension and insecurity among these white ball players.
But they're also in Philadelphia, and again, this is 1947, Jackie, the hotel, the Benjamin Franklin Hotel, didn't want to rent him a room for the night while he came to the city to play. This is off the field, not on the field.
That's right. And that happened almost everywhere Robinson went in 1947. He couldn't stay with his teammates. He couldn't eat with his teammates. The Dodgers hired a black newspaper writer to keep Robinson company and to room with him on the road because they, we were still living in a very segregated world. Some of the ballparks still had segregated seating. And Robinson began to change all that. I think that's really important to note that when Robinson integrated the Dodgers, other institutions began to think about whether they should integrate too. This is before Brown versus Board of Education. It's before the Army is even integrated. And Robinson forces people to rethink this. You know, if he can play on our team, how come he can't stay in our hotel? Well, before that, a lot of white people weren't even asking that question.
I'm looking at a quote, and this is the first time that he encounters playing with the Phillies. You mentioned this, Jonathan. I just want to quote here, and this is Jackie Robinson. He says, "I have to admit that this day, of all the unpleasant days of my life, brought me nearer to cracking up than I have ever been. For one wild and crazed minute, I thought, to hell with Mr. Rickey's noble experiment." I quote that because I'm curious about what you think the psychological price that Jackie Robinson played for, in a sense, sucking it up and having to deal with what he dealt with both on the field and off.
Yeah, it's a hard question. I talked to his wife, Rachel, about this a bit. And the thing she stressed to me was that you need to understand the sense of responsibility he felt in 1947, you know, throughout his career, but especially in 1947. He felt like all of Black America was not just watching him, but counting on him, that if this experiment worked, if he could prove that he belonged, that he could compete with white people and make this ball club better, then all kinds of other opportunities would open up. He really believed that this was a chance for him to advance the cause of equality, not just to advance his own career, not just to make his team better. He really understood, which is rare for somebody living through a historic moment, to understand the full impact of it. So there was this enormous pressure on him, and yet it went against every instinct he had. He was just a very argumentative, very combative man who did not like to take any crap from people. So I think he really felt like he was, you know, on the verge of exploding. And you know, did that have, you know, long-term effects on his health? hard to say, but it was a lot of stress for anybody to live with.
I'm asking you to get into the head of Jackie Robinson, or perhaps I'll just ask you directly. So what do you make of the apology passed unanimously by City Council here in Philadelphia, essentially apologizing for the mistreatment of Jackie Robinson by the Phillies?
Yeah, I think it's terrific. I think that we all are taught to apologize when we do something wrong, even if it's not your fault. You've hurt somebody. It's never too late to apologize. And I think it just sends the message that these things do matter. The way we treat people matters. And that when we make mistakes, even if, we can't see them at the time, we can go back and atone for them. I think that's a great lesson for everybody.
Let me squeeze a caller on. We've got Mark. It looks like Mark from Fairhill joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the writer was familiar with Fleetwood Moses Walker and wondering, if it was as bad for Jackie Robinson coming into the major leagues, what it must have been like for Fleetwood Moses Walker, late 19th, early 20th century, basically being the black man who was the last kicked out of what was becoming the major leagues when men like Cap Anson said, if that nigger's on the field, my team won't go out and play against him, leading to that period of baseball segregation, which actually hadn't existed before.
Mark, it's a good question. Let me see if Jonathan and I can respond to that. Jonathan, have you looked at that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's sort of the mirror image of what Jackie experienced. Walker didn't know that he was going to be the last ball player. There was this movement to push blacks out of baseball, something that was really inspired by the racism of a few managers and ball players. So he clearly faced a different kind of prejudice, being forced out of the game. But at the same time, blacks didn't have anywhere near the status in society and the ability to fight that at the time. When Robinson came along, in some ways it was more difficult because he was, not only facing that same racism, but he was breaking a barrier that had been erected. And that just presents a very different set of challenges.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jonathan Eich, thank you for joining us today on the show as well.
Thank you.
Jonathan Eich, author of Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season. WHYY is airing Ken Burns' documentary about Jackie Robinson. In fact, you can watch it Saturday night at 7 p.m. on TV 12. Also, filmmaker David McMahon and WHYY members are going to be at the Phillies game tonight celebrating Jackie Robinson as he is being celebrated in baseball stadiums across the country. Very short break, and then we shift gears. We'll be talking about last night's debate in Brooklyn between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. We've got two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton met last night for a feisty and boisterous debate in Brooklyn, broadcast on CNN, a few days before the New York primary and less than 2 weeks before the Pennsylvania and Delaware primaries on April 26. Gone was the patina of politeness and deference. The two sparred over a wide range of domestic and foreign policy issues. It began with a discussion about qualifications and judgments, a question posed by Wolf Blitzer.
Does Secretary Clinton have the experience and the intelligence to be a president? Of course she does. But I do question her judgment. I question a judgment which voted for the war in Iraq, the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of this country, voted for virtually every disastrous trade agreement, which cost us millions of decent-paying jobs. And I question her judgment about running super PACs, which are collecting tens of millions of dollars from special interests, including $15 million from Wall Street. I don't believe that is the kind of judgment we need to be the kind of president we need.
Secretary Clinton, Well, it is true that now that the spotlight is pretty bright here in New York, some things have been said, and Senator Sanders did call me unqualified. I've been called a lot of things in my life. That was a first. And then he did say that he had to question my judgment. Well, the people of New York voted for me twice to be their senator from New York. President Obama trusted my judgment enough to ask me to be Secretary of State for the United States.
Well, we will play more clips from last night's debate, but first let me introduce our guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Harold Jackson, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He writes the Under the Sun blog. And Harold Jackson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So Will Bunch is with us as well, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. He authors the Attitude blog, and he wrote a book called The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. And Will, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Yeah, it's good to be back, Marty. Thanks.
I have to say to our listeners, we were talking about this before going on the air, and it's pretty clear, Will, that these two people are completely sick of each other.
Absolutely. I mean, this was the most predictable development. I mean, everybody's talking about how feisty the debate was, but this is the ninth time they've been on that stage. You know, they've said a lot of things. They've gone to that phase. It reminds me of 2008 with Barack Obama's famous "You're likable enough, Hillary" comment. We're at the "You're likable enough, barely" phase of this campaign, I think.
That they would say to each other. Harold, yeah. What was your takeaway from last night?
Well, what you said, it was a very feisty debate, which made it very entertaining, but there wasn't very much new there. There were some things that were different. The fact that Mr. Sanders went for at length about the Palestinians and the need to look at the Middle East through from their perspective. For him to do that in New York, which we know has a large pro-Israel population there, a lot of Jewish people that live there. I thought it was a bold move on his part. I think it probably will cost him in the long run, but I thought that was different. But most of what they did was the same give and take we've heard before. And so if we were tired of seeing it, I'm sure they were tired of hearing it themselves.
Yeah. But you think cost him in New York?
I think it could. You know, it's just a matter of how many people actually pay attention to these debates. It was on CNN, a cable channel. I'm not sure how many people actually tuned in. I think people in the pro-Israel movement paid attention.
I
would like to have you do that. Go ahead, Will.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm not sure if it hurts them as much as people think. I mean, I think it reflects a lot of changes within the Democratic Party and within the liberal point of view on the whole situation in the Middle East. You know, we've had Netanyahu as prime minister for several stints now for a long time. There's a lot of people who don't approve, who support Israel's right to exist, support Zionism on some level, but they don't like what this particular government has been doing and the way it's responded to the Palestinians. And I think he's tapped into something. And I think there's a lot of Jewish voters. I mean, there are more and more liberal Jewish groups like J Street that say we support Israel, but we don't support these current policies. And he got it. He got an excellent response. I mean, the crowd was something last night. I thought I was watching or hearing the laugh track to a really bad sitcom from the 1980s. I mean, it was way over the
everything
top.
Everything was responded to.
Right. It kind of just for a viewer at home trying to sort out these candidates, it was kind of a distraction, I thought. But on the main point, I mean, I thought it was great to have the moderators let them go to have this debate on Middle East policy that we don't always hear in the American mainstream often enough. You know?
Well, go ahead, Harold.
I do think that to make the comment that to suggest that Mrs. Clinton made a mistake by not mentioning the plight of the Palestinians at a speech she made to AIPAC was somewhat ridiculous, actually.
He didn't go to AIPAC.
No,
Bernie Sanders.
Well, he did speak to them by phone, so he did address them. So,
but why ridiculous?
Because that's a group that would not be pro-Palestinian.
So why would you say something like that?
So why would she make a speech in which she endorsed the perspective of the Palestinians? So I agree with Will that for his particular audience, it played well. But I don't know that it won him any additional votes, and that's where he is right now. He's trying to expand his electorate, and I heard nothing last night that would do that.
Well, let me pick up on a different set of speeches, ones that she gave to Wall Street. And, Harold, she's been asked this before. Much of this has been discussed before. Her answer has pretty much been the same, which is that I'll release the transcripts when everyone else does. Bernie, of course, says I'll do that because he's never given those kinds of speeches. Is this going to hurt her? And is there a better answer that she could give?
I don't know that there's a better answer other than I'm releasing the transcripts tomorrow.
You think that's the right one?
Of course it is. Mrs. Clinton appeared before the Inquirer editorial board for an endorsement meeting about a week ago, and she was asked several times about this particular topic. Now, you know, by her not releasing the tapes, the transcripts, it suggests that she has something to hide. I assume that she does. What it might be, I don't know. It could be that in a group, if I've made speeches before, not for pay, but when I'm speaking before a group, certainly I make statements that are complimentary of that group. Mm-hmm. Just imagine her saying something complimentary of Goldman Sachs that would come back to haunt her. It might not be anything really, you know, that suggests that she has any type of quid pro quo. But any statement that she made, and her being as careful as she is, she doesn't want to release it. But in the long run, it hurts her.
I mean, let me go back to you, Will, because Bernie Sanders was asked, is there anything that she has done that would tell us that she's in the pocket of Wall Street?
Right. I'm glad you brought it up and asked it that way, because that's something I've given a lot of thought to. And the thing is, we want ethical politicians. We want them to avoid the appearance of a conflict, you know, and the fact that Hillary Clinton and her husband, Bill Clinton, the former president, have given so many speeches to so many interested parties that have huge issues before the federal government, not just Goldman Sachs, although Goldman Sachs is the most ironic one. There's a huge issue going on right now here in Philadelphia, too, which is the strike by Verizon workers. Hillary Clinton gave a paid speech to Verizon. And I don't want to go too in the weeds. I mean, there have been people who have looked at donations that the UBS, the large Swiss bank, gave to the Clinton Foundation and what the State Department did. So there are, if you want to go into the weeds, there are some issues. But I think more broadly, I think the appearance here is terrible. And I'm totally with Harold on the releasing the transcript issue. You know, she's tried to trivialize this issue. I've talked to many voters in this campaign on the Democratic side, and the one issue that motivates people more than any other is people want big money out of politics. I just hear that time and time again. It's the reason Bernie Sanders has been able to mount such a successful challenge to this. And if you don't like big money in politics, then you don't like the way that Hillary Clinton's been running her campaign.
Well, let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog is Attitude, which is how we say the word attitude here in Philadelphia. Also with us, Harold Jackson, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His blog, Under the Sun, and we are talking about last night's debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you watched the debate, who you thought won or lost, or what were some key moments for you that matter to you as this race goes forward. Let me play another clip, and this is Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. They're discussing energy policy with a reference to the Paris Climate Agreement. Let's give it a listen.
When you were Secretary of State, you also worked hard to expand fracking to countries all over the world. But the issue here, of course the agreement is a step forward, but you know agreements and I know agreements, there's a lot of paper there. We've got to get beyond paper right now. We have got to lead the world in transforming our energy system, not tomorrow, but yesterday. And what that means, Wolf, it means having the guts to take on the fossil fuel industry. Now, I am on board. Legislation says, you know what? We ain't going to excavate for fossil fuel on public land. That's not Secretary Clinton's position. Let us support a tax on carbon, not Secretary Clinton's position.
Secretary, go ahead and respond.
Well, I'm a little bewildered about how to respond when you have an agreement which gives you the framework to actually take the action that would have only come about because under the Obama administration, in the face of implacable hostility from the Republicans in Congress, President Obama moved forward on gas mileage. He moved forward on the Clean Power Plan. He has moved forward on so many of the fronts that he could, given the executive actions that he was able to take.
And again, another clip from last night's debate. What I thought was a little wonky, but what I thought it was interesting about this, Harold, is that in many ways you see Hillary Clinton as the sort of practical candidate. Bernie Sanders in this interchange basically says, we have to get on some kind of a war footing because this is a crisis. This is, you know, could be the death of the planet. And she's saying, look, we have this agreement. We're going to use this as a framework moving forward, a more incremental approach.
Well, that really is the way the entire campaign is framed, really. It's not just on this issue. And that's the criticism of Mr. Sanders, is that often he will say things that are certainly correct in terms of where the direction of the country should be, the direction of the world would be. But when you ask him to provide the actual blueprint for how to get there, it's lacking. And, you know, to say that the United States is not the world leader in seeking an answer to climate change is, you know, pretty ludicrous. Now, President Obama has done quite a bit given the Republican Congress that he has to work with. But is it enough? No. But to portray him as the administration as being not involved, I think, was a bit going a bit too far.
What do you think, Will?
Well, it's a complicated issue. I mean, as far as President Obama, I mean, I think it's taken him 8 years to really come around to probably close to where he should be on climate change. You know, most of his presidency, he pursued this all of the above policy, and the U.S. became the world's largest fossil fuel producer. I mean, that doesn't sound like the policies of somebody who feels climate change is a dire emergency, as James Hansen and many other climate scientists feel. So, you know, I think to the broader point here, I mean, what I find fascinating about this race is, you know, I mean, Harold's absolutely right. I mean, Hillary Clinton is the more detail-oriented candidate. There's no question about that. You can pick that up in 5 minutes watching them on a debate.
Sure.
But there's more to being a president than details. There's also leadership. And I think one of the best arguments for Bernie Sanders is, I think he's, you know, he's shown leadership on this issue, that we need to take bold stances to move people on some of these urgent issues. I mean, just quickly.
But how do you do that? I mean, my question is, and he talks about the revolution. Right. It's clear his supporters are 100% behind him. He's saying that the revolution starts with the public and then we change government. But how are you going to move? How are you going to move the Republican leadership in Congress? I mean, this is the boring practicalities of governing.
Of course. But, you know, the thing that people forget is how is Hillary Clinton going to move the practical, you know, Barack Obama wasn't able to. Hillary Clinton's going to face the same opposition. Bernie Sanders is saying this game isn't working. We need to try and change the game. And, you know, that's an argument mm-hmm. a lot of people are buying. You know, when he came to our editorial board meeting here, I think he gave next to the best case scenario, which was on a different issue, the $15 minimum wage. You know, he was, you know, several years ahead of the rest of the Democratic establishment on urging a $15 minimum wage. And that approach really caught fire. It caught people's imagination. You've seen a movement. You've seen people marching. They were marching here yesterday for that.
That's right.
And you've seen state governments in New York and California, two of the four biggest states in the country, come around on this issue. That's leadership.
What do you think? Then we'll get some callers in.
Certainly. I like the fact that there's that fire in Bernie Sanders. However, you know, it borders at times at being demagogic. If you offer the Republic nothing more than the fire without a real way to reach that goal, then what good is it? The minimum wage is a great example of that. I certainly believe people should make $15 an hour as a minimum wage. But, you know, if there's a route to get there that includes $9.99, that includes $12.95, and then $15. If that's the best route to get there, then I can be persuaded that that's the route to go, rather than we have to have $15 now without looking at any consequences of that.
Let me read a Twitter comment. It says, if Hillary releases her speeches, Bernie will just nitpick them as much as Bernie's tax returns will ever be released. He said they're going to something. 2014, I think, is going to get released today. I mean, is this speeches versus tax returns, Will?
Well, I mean, I just think they're both issues of right and wrong. And I mean, I think we want to see our candidates release their tax returns, and I want to see Bernie Sanders' tax returns.
He says they're really boring.
Yeah, he does. You know, I mean, his wife, you know, got a big severance payment when she left her job at Burlington College. Maybe they don't want to talk about that. You know, I remember 15 years ago, it came out Ralph Nader had stock in a lot of large American corporations. I mean, he could have a situation like that. I mean, certainly there'd be, there's always room for some political embarrassment. And so I think it's a legitimate issue. And I think, I don't know if there's necessarily a parallel between the speeches. I just think they're both happen to be the right thing to do.
Harold, you had a piece comparing Bernie Sanders to Howard Beale, not entirely, but I'm just not going to take it anymore, Howard Beale. What's the connection there?
Well, again, in that particular column, that blog post said that, I'm not comparing their personalities, but the movement itself is similar, and that it's a movement that's based on emotion, on working people up and getting them fired up for change. But, that's not enough, of course. You have to have something beyond just firing the people up. And, Mr. Sanders came to see us. We've been listening to him. We read the New York Daily News transcript of their editorial board meeting. And too frequently, there's nothing beyond firing people up. If you go to his website, if you look at all of the different – he has this extensive website with the programs he wants to bring about, how to fund them with massive tax increases. And you come away saying, how is much of this really possible within – the realm of any presidency, especially one who can't count on either house being controlled by his party.
We're almost up on a break here, but do you wonder, Will, whether Democrats who support either both of these candidates or perhaps even more Hillary Clinton, they worry that Bernie Sanders will be the George McGovern of 2016, won one state.
Right. Well, he'd have to get the nomination first. And I think there's a given the delegate situation, I think there's only about a 2% chance of that happening. So, by pulling the party to the left, I don't think so. I think this country is moving to the left. I think we have in place what we call the Obama coalition that's shown in the last two elections that a coalition of non-whites, of white professionals, of young people it comprises at least 52-53% of the electorate. And I think that coalition wants this country to keep moving to the center left.
Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation with Will Bunch and Harold Jackson, talking about the race for the White House, specifically last night's debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, what's ahead for these two particular candidates. And the sky's the limit when talking about running for the White House. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Will Bunch. He's a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog, Attitude, A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D, that's how we say that word here in Philadelphia, also wrote a book called The Byrne Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Harold Jackson with us as well, editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And his blog, Under the Sun, you can read both these blogs at philly.com. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-94. 99, dissecting last night's debate and also taking comments, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play one more clip from last night. This had to do with the crime bill that was signed by President Clinton. Hillary Clinton was asked if she regretted her past advocacy for the crime bill. And then after her response, New York One anchor Errol Lewis passed the question on to Bernie Sanders.
I supported the crime bill. My husband has apologized. He was the president who actually signed it.
But what about you, Senator?
I'm sorry for the consequences that were unintended and that have had a very unfortunate impact on people's lives. I've seen the results of what has happened in families and in communities. That's why I chose to make my very first speech a year ago on this issue, Errol, because I want to focus the attention of our country and to make the changes we need to make. And I also want people, especially I want white people to recognize that there is systemic racism. It's also in employment, it's in housing, but it is in the criminal justice system as well.
Senator Sanders, earlier this week at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, you called out President Clinton for defending Secretary Clinton's use of the term super predator back in the 90s when she supported the crime bill. Why did you call him out?
Because it was a racist term and everybody knew it was a racist term. Look. Much of what Secretary Clinton said was right. You had a crime bill. I voted for it. It had the Violence Against Women Act in it. When mayor of Burlington, we worked very hard to try to eliminate domestic violence. This took us a good step forward.
Again, another clip from last night's debate. And Harold, it's so interesting and perhaps appropriate that this crime bill passed, I should say, pretty strongly by both parties, including by Bernie Sanders. He signed off on this as well, that that has now become such an important issue in this particular campaign.
Well, it is interesting. And you have to go back to the 90s and remember the times there. You know, at that period, I was a reporter in Baltimore, Maryland, you know, some of the same streets that we've seen in the David Simon series in West Baltimore. And Mr. Sanders noted the word super predator being used and saying it's a racist term. Everything is in context, and it's not a naturally racist word in that it's unlike some others that we know. In the context that it was made, perhaps so. But I can compare this to the situation we have with the stop and frisk situation in Philadelphia. Some of the same people who are being victimized by that policy also want it because they do feel that it does make their streets safer to know the police there are there and they're enforcing the law. Well, super predator, I would dare say if you went into the streets of West Baltimore in the 1990s and called a crack dealer on the street who was recruiting 13-year-olds to sling drugs for them, they might call that person a super predator as well.
And that's what Bill Clinton referenced when he was in Philadelphia, taking on someone from Black Lives Matter on this issue. Will, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember the 1994 crime bill. I was a reporter in New York, and it is a very complicated issue, as you can tell. You know, and like you said, Bernie Sanders voted for it.
It has many parts.
I was just going to say, it had so many elements to it. I was saying to somebody last night, my biggest memory of that bill was conservatives ripping it apart because it had this thing in there called midnight basketball, and like that. We're coddling criminals by paying money for them to play these basketball games. That was the perception of the bill to a lot of people now. So it's fascinating to see how the perception has changed. But I mean, the perception has changed because of a fact that is inescapable, which is that the United States imprisons more of its citizens than any developed country in the world by a lot. And many of these people are in there for lower level offenses. They're not "quote unquote super predators," no matter how you define that word, whether it's racist or not. One thing that's important to note, and it doesn't get brought up enough, I think, in these debates, is it's the mass incarceration is largely a state and local problem. The federal government, only about 10%, if that much, of the prison population is from federal offenses. So it's a much broader issue. Absolutely.
And that's Will Bunch, who joins us along with Harold Jackson. We are talking about the race for the White House, focusing specifically on Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. There was a debate last night. It was pretty feisty. We've been playing some clips. You could hear both the candidates and also the adoring fans on both sides at this big factory somewhere in Brooklyn. And we want to hear from you. We want to know what you're thinking about this race for the White House, where you think it's going, the issues that you care about, who you're going to vote for. All of that is fair game. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Harold, you talked about the angry voters and some of the angry voters that are supporting Bernie Sanders. How would you compare them to what appears to be the angry voters who are supporting Donald Trump?
Well, they're very similar. If you listen to them, their complaints are pretty much the same. They feel that government is ineffective. Government does not represent them. They've tried the regular route of electing politicians who will fulfill their wishes for what government should do, and each time they're disappointed. So from the conservative point of view, from the right to from the left, they're both looking for that person who can actually embody what I want to see government do for me. And they're not finding it.
It's a legitimate
It's definitely a legitimate emotion
to have.
Certainly, with Congress being, in this partisan divide that has rendered it ineffective on the bigger issues facing this country. Yeah, it's very legitimate.
What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people are angry because they have a right to be angry. You know, the American government is, by and large, not working very well for the people. I mean, the biggest example of that, I think, is income inequality. You know, we've seen almost all the income gains in the last 20 years flow to the top 1%. Well, you know, the 99% people are working 2-3 jobs to pay for college. I mean, to go back to your original question, I mean, what's the difference between Donald Trump's angry people and Bernie Sanders' angry people, and it's just who they blame and how they want to solve it. You know, Donald Trump has been, in my opinion, a shameless exploiter of people's worst fears. At times he's appealed to people's xenophobia. At times he's appealed to blatant racism at his worst moments. In the case of Bernie Sanders, the people who are supporting him, they want the government to help them. I mean, that was something, again, when I attended a lot of Bernie Sanders rallies, writing my ebook, The Burn Identity, last year, and talked to a lot of people. What I heard time and time again is, whether it was family leave, taking care of a sick relative, or college tuition. I mean, I just can't stress enough what an issue that is for the voters, particularly the ones who are supporting Bernie Sanders. The fact, that my son's living in the basement because he's still paying off his student loans. I mean, these are real issues affecting people's lives. And so these angry people are looking for the government to help them. The people lining up behind Trump tend to have an anti-government mindset.
You know, Harold, I'm thinking about, we did a show earlier this week on the Panama Papers. These are the papers that are showing us the special deals that the rich, the powerful, the famous, the infamous, how they can use the system to hide their wealth, to not pay their taxes, which in my mind just sort of underscores the kind of anger people have about how, if you play by the rules and all this kind of stuff, the system is really rigged against you.
Well, yeah, that's the result of an America in which the middle class has found itself, really stressed out. The 1% continues to earn more income. The middle class is not just the lower income people, it's the middle class now. And I think that's the strain that we're seeing in America right now. You know, there's a joke that if you wondered how the Panama Papers reveal so much about what America is about, have similar papers written about the state of Delaware,
right,
where people are similarly hiding their money. But the point is, Americans feel like they need someone, some entity that comes to their rescue that helps them. There was a lot of trust, a lot of hope placed in President Obama, largely because of the partisan divide in Congress. He was not able to accomplish what people hoped he would in that regard. They find that they're farther behind than they thought they would be at this point, and so now they're looking for a different solution. The problem for Mr. Sanders, I think, is that for him to get addressed that, he has to, even if it's indirectly, attack the fact that President Obama has been president for 8 years, and I don't think he's done what should have been done, which is why Ms. Clinton keeps referring to Obama, Obama, Obama. Sanders may be obliquely doing it, but his whole campaign really is a criticism of the past 8 years.
Let me see what Chris from South Philadelphia has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I guess I'm going back to a point you guys were discussing earlier with respect to the crime bill, and I wanted to note to you quickly that, at least according to Michelle Alexander in the New Jim Crow, 4 out of 5 arrests are for possession, not for sale, distribution, trafficking, or anything along these lines, and often low-level possession. And that is, overstocked the prisons with, incarcerated citizens, which in turn follows them well beyond their periods of incarceration, well onto, into their lives post incarceration, either parole or probation, where they are subject to high levels of scrutiny, limited employment opportunity, limited access to educational opportunities, and so on and so forth, thus creating a endless cycle of recidivism.
Well, Chris, I think you've frankly summarized the results, perhaps unintended, of the crime bill, and I think, Will, people are beginning to think as Chris does, which is to say, wait a minute, let's look at the fallout from throwing so many people in prison.
Well, certainly, on the left side of the dial, in the Democratic Party, I was just going to say one of the biggest roars of response from this, World Wrestling Federation type crowd last night was when Bernie Sanders said we need to just end the war on drugs. I mean, that would have been considered, a gaffe or faux pas 15 years ago, right? And now it's a huge applause line. So I think I don't know about for the American majority, but certainly within the Democratic Party, this has become the majority view, that the drug war has been a massive failure.
Well, I think one thing that Mr. Sanders also pointed out is that now you have conservative governors in southern states agreeing because they no longer can afford this incarceration rate. And so there is the opportunity there for something to change dramatically in this country on that issue.
Harold, I wonder if we're getting a sort of a weird civics lesson on how we elect presidents, the role of delegates, superdelegates, the role of parties, how the rules vary from one state to the other. Then we've got the convention rules that are going to come in July. And I think a lot of people are scratching their heads saying, no, wait a minute. When I vote, I thought I was voting for a particular candidate, but there's all this machinery in between.
Certainly, and the rules do change from state to state. This isn't the first time the system's been criticized. Many times the American public has come to the realization that the popular vote is not really the issue here, that you can have the popular vote even in the general election and find that you don't win a presidency.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very complicated, very complex system, but it is a democracy.
But it is democracy. Go ahead, Will.
Is it, though? I mean, you know, I mean, there's so many problems. I mean, I'll just give you one example that's bothered me right now is look at the state of New York. In New York, they have a closed primary, so you have to be a registered Democrat or a registered Republican to vote in those primaries. The cutoff date for changing your party registration was in October before anybody – I mean, think of all the excitement that Bernie Sanders, think of all the excitement, for want of a better term, that Donald Trump has generated among voters who weren't paying attention before October. You're an independent, whatever, you want to register. You can't change your party registration now. I find that absurd. It's very undemocratic. And that's just one example of some of the things we've seen this year, that people have really been disenfranchised.
And just for the point of devil's argument, I would say there will be also those who would say that we don't want opportunists jumping into the party for one election.
Let me see if I can squeeze. And to our listeners, don't call 3 minutes before the show is going to end. Call earlier and we can get you in on the show. Let me get Frank from Palmyra to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Marty, could you frame this into a question for your guest? The idea that Bernie all these years has been on the defense of explaining democratic socialism to his opponents, that he really hasn't programmatically worked out solutions to all our society's problems.
Well, I think you did just ask the question. Let me give Will a chance to respond to that.
Right. Well, I, as we said earlier, I think he's offered what I would call leadership positions. And he does, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds, but he does actually have a program, for example, breaking up the banks. There's been a lot of talk about that. He does understand how it would work. But I think he feels – I think what the caller said is true. I think he's trying to educate people more on a broader system than on the kind of wonky details. And he's gotten some criticism for that. So.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, and Karen says, what are the guests' opinion of their pledge to support whomever the Democratic nominee is? And even beyond that, Harold, the supporters, I mean, will the supporters, whoever wins, will the loser's supporters support the winner?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we find that the candidates on both sides are sort of hedging their bets. Even Hillary and Bernie seem to hedge their bets and pledging direct support for whoever wins the nomination. I think they will. On the Republican side, they have a bigger problem with that. And we're going to see some real interesting things in Cleveland.
Yeah, or some interesting things here in Philadelphia as well. Well,
I think so, yeah.
I mean, do you think Bernie's people would support Hillary? I'm asking you to speak for millions here.
Yeah, I think by and large, yes. It's what we saw in 2008 when it was just as bitter between Obama and Hillary Clinton then. I think you're going to largely see that now. There is some question about some of Bernie's young supporters. But honestly, you know, I think these were people who might not have voted at all, had enough in for Bernie's candidacy. So it might not be a huge
impact.
That's
the real issue, whether they will vote at all.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, much more to talk about. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Harold Jackson, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Editorial page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He writes the Under the Sun blog. Will Bunch, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
Senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, his blog, Attitude, and he also wrote a book that came out last year called The Byrne Identity, The Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.